Session number 9856.
Mr. Morgan Reel, four.
I'd had a very strange upbringing. Most of my early years, I was ill from one child's complaint after another. So I didn't really start school until I was 9 years of age. But somehow during that period, I was able to read very fluently, and we had a house full of books, and I lived almost alone in that intellectual or unreal world for all those years. And then in my early teens, I just kept on reading at least one book every day and two or three books every day on holidays. And I rarely came into contact with other people around me in the normal course of events. So when I found myself in this room in the concentration camp, with about 150 people there, all older than myself, this was the first time I'd ever had contact with people much older than myself, apart from my own family, of course, and neighbors. And these are people drawn from so many different parts of the world, people who had experienced working conditions, people who had experienced strikes and hunger strikes and hunger marches. I realized what life is like for people who are no longer children. Up until then, I'd been really a child. And even when I argued politics in the university and wrote them, it was all purely cerebral, something I'd never experienced myself, simply material I'd gathered from other books. And it helped me to synthesize my views of the world. And when I came back from there, I read a book by Engels called The Origin of the Family. I can't remember much of the detail, but what I do remember is his saying that everything is in a process of change, that the family as a unit isn't a permanent unit, it's something which exists at the present moment. And I've been reading before then all the books by J.D. Fraser on the Golden Bough. And it is quite evident to me that, to quote, I think it is Marx, who said, the only constant in nature is change. And I realized for the first time that all the reading I'd ever done in archaeology, in history, biology, science, ordinary fiction, all pointed to the same thing, that the world is forever in a process of change. And that, I think, is the one factor which has dominated my whole life. There is no point in attempting to conserve things when, in point of fact, they're changing all the time. And the history of evolution, according to Darwin, is that it is simply by coping in new conditions that man has evolved out of a more primitive kind. And all this life in the concentration camp was a sort of forcing house for me of attempting to integrate book learning with reality such as it is.
Were there any individuals who stick out in your mind who made a particular impression on you in prison?
None at all. It is simply all people, not people of great brains or great intelligence, but simply the combined feeling that here was humanity as a whole. And somehow we all had this one thing in common, that we'd be alive for about 70 years and then we die. And in that period of 70 years, we would try to achieve something or not try to achieve. Some are content merely with living. Others would attempt to achieve something. With some people, it might be a career. With other people, it might be to make a lot of money. But with me, it's kept to the same thing of looking for understanding. If I could understand how life came into existence and how it evolved throughout the whole years and produced modern man, that to me was wholly satisfying, and I wanted nothing more than that. And I know when I left the prison, I made no attempt whatsoever to get a job. The idea of working for a living had never honestly occurred to me. I had never considered where money came from, where food came from, where clothes came from. I was simply content to be alive and found it marvellous. And it was only then by accident that I started working for a living. When the headmaster of the local grammar school sent me a note, asked me, would I like to come and teach at the school, which I did.
In captivity in Spain, was there any... What was your relationship with your captors like? Was it one of rebelliousness towards them or conforming to what they required?
A combination of both, I think. We conform, we'd line up to get our food, things like that. At the same time, we hated their guts, particularly one sergeant who loved using power over helpless people. I mentioned earlier that we had sores from our waist under the ankles, and they were particularly bad behind the knee, at the joint where they would crack. And we always had to go downstairs into the patio for our meals, down a winding stone staircase, and he'd take a particular delight in being there with a truncheon to make us run down the steps and run back up again in order to have our food. And we hated his guts. On the other hand, the ordinary Spanish soldier was a great chap. The guards we had, I know we had to be on duty. After people escaped from the place, they decided to appoint people to act as warders at night time to report anyone who tried to escape. Well, what we'd all do, we'd all go down and have a chat with a guard at the door at the very bottom. And I found them delightful people. Very unlettered, quite uneducated, simple chaps eating very much the same food as we were eating, not very much different. Typical Spanish food, mostly beans they had, beans and a bit of bread and sardines. Very simple-minded. The Spanish homes in those days were very, very primitive. You'd have the family living inside a room with a table in the middle, a charcoal heater under the table to warm their feet. The walls were simply bare stone with saucepans and whatnots hanging from a nail in the wall. And maybe in the same room you had some animals as well, like cattle and goats. I remember showing to one guard a picture of a lounge chair, an English lounge chair. And he thought I was pulling his leg when I told him it was a lounge chair. He knew what a chair looked like. It had four legs in the back. He couldn't believe that this thing I was showing him was a lounge chair. And when he saw the other articles of clothing and furniture there, he just couldn't believe that ordinary working class people would use that sort of furniture. And this has been quite a factor, I believe, in the transformation, the rapid transformation of Franco's dictatorship into a democracy. At one time, I would not go to Spain for a holiday on principle. I didn't want to put money into the coffers of Franco and his government. But I now see I was quite wrong. I should have gone there. Because when you have foreign tourists going to a backward country like Spain, they want modern amenities in the holiday resorts. In the holiday resorts, you have the peasants who are becoming servants. When they can see that the foreigners want TV, radio, indoor toilets, hot and cold, sun heating, then they say, well, why on earth shouldn't we have it? Particularly when they learn that the visitors are themselves working class, not wealthy people. And that, I think, has done more to transform Spain than any other single factor.
Was there any baiting of guards, teasing them?
Oh, no. No. We didn't often see guards. We were kept in this room all day long. Occasionally there'd be a raid by the guards coming in, thinking that some of us had knives, which could be used as weapons. They'd be pretty rough, but then they'd go and we wouldn't see them again for quite a number of days. On the whole, they were simply concerned with doing their job. There was one chap who was a nasty piece of work. I remember on one occasion, about five or six of us taken down into a courtyard. made to face the wall. They're going to shoot us. And there we were against the wall, then they shoot, deliberately missing us, and then have a very good laugh. Send us back up again.
Did foreign agencies like the Gestapo operate in Spanish prisons?
Yeah, we were all taken out once, one at a time, to be investigated by the Nazis. The Germans had a real grilling from them. But in my case, and with the other people, it simply looked simply like a normal oral test. They asked me, first of all, was I a Jew? I said, no, why do you think that? Well, first of all, because you're very keen. And secondly, you say your name, Morgan. Yeah? And I said, no. Then he said to me, had I ever read The Capital? I said, no, I've read The Citadel, but not The Capital. And it wasn't until I'd left the whole place I'd realized that what they were referring to was Das Kapital.
What is The Citadel?
That's by Cronin, isn't it? A.J. Cronin. Yeah? And they simply wanted to know what sort of background I came from, and were we roughs, were we down and out, were we unemployed, what education do we have, if any. They really didn't believe that we were anything but roughs and rabble. And in some of the propaganda I read in Spain, they classified the brigaders as the lowest of the low. And the Catholic Church particularly did that. When, at a later date, we were paraded to the streets of San Sebastian, the loudspeakers kept on telling the people, here are the men, the criminals who come to Spain to rape their wives and daughters, you know, or to kill their children. And they may possibly believe that, I don't know. But these Gestapo people were certainly surprised to find that in our group, on our floor, there are a good many people with degrees, and quite a lot of professional men as well.
How many Germans interrogated you?
Every member is three.
Were they in military uniform?
No, plain clothes. Plain clothes. They looked quite cultured, quite educated, and no rough stuff at all.
How were they introduced to you, if in any way?
Oh, no, we were taken into this room, you see, one at a time.
Were you told who they were?
Ah, we were told for a psychological examination, if I remember rightly. But it's easy to see where they're getting at, you see. But the Germans, they had a really tough time with them, because they had records on the Germans. And this is why, of course, the Germans were the ones who were most determined to escape if they could. They knew there'd be no future for them in Germany if they went back.
So were the Germans beaten under interrogation?
No, they weren't either.
You talked about San Sebastian. Were you transferred from Burgos to San Sebastian?
Yeah, when we were leaving, we were taken to San Sebastian and put in this prison. We got there, we were marched on the streets, then we went in to the place, and there was a big hall with tiers of cells all round. And word obviously had got abroad that we were the International Brigaders, and we'd had a grand welcome from the Spanish people in San Sebastian, the Basques. They slipped us cigarettes, tobacco, papers, chocolate. And then when we got to prison, out of the cells they pour down all this confection of chocolate, sugar chocolate, not milk chocolate, and cigarette paper and tobacco. And then one chap in a grey civilian suit was in charge of taking our fingerprints. And he pointed at himself and said, "You're mucho bloody rojo. I'm a bloody red, you know." And even when the trustees there, they were so short of manpower, presumably. And then we were put into underground cells, where the doors were left open, and it was lit by two very low-powered bulbs, one at each end. At least they looked low-powered. You could never be certain when the walls and ceiling are dark whether the light is weak or whether it's strong. You know, it's all absorbed by the wall. And I remembered initially they took a grim delight in giving us for food fish heads with the eyes in them, you know. Not the sort of food I could tackle in the light. So we all had to go into the darkness, turn our backs to any light, and eat it there. And then they'd bring down some loaves of bread, and they'd throw the bread on the floor, hoping to see us all scrabbling for it. But the discipline with these people was very, very good. Self-discipline. And there was no scrabbling for the food, you know. It just picked up gradually, carefully, the people put together, and then we all took a piece of bread as you wanted it. And then we were able to communicate with other prisoners through tapping the pipes. They're quite hollow. I can't remember now how he did it, because I certainly didn't know any Morse code. But somehow or other it was done. And then we were given clothes to go back. We were given the trousers, obviously. A beret. Boots, I believe. And perhaps a shirt or a smock. And the prisoners there wanted to get hold of some of these things. So we swapped the shoes that they really wanted for tobacco. And everyone was delighted by the swap. And then finally we were swapped for prisoners held by the government. Now Franco had only captured, say, 300 or 400. They shot all the rest. And the government had not done so much of that. And they had something like 40,000 prisoners. So it meant, in effect, that one of us had changed for about 100 of the other ones. But it's only a numerical correlation, and that's all. And then we came back, and that was that.
Were you asked to sign any undertaking by the Franco authorities about not coming back to Spain?
No. But we were charged £4 by the British government for our repatriation.
Did you pay it?
I did, but Edwin Greening didn't.
When you got back to Britain, what kind of reception did you receive?
Oh, a very good reception. On the boat across, for example, some middle-class people returning for a holiday. They're most kind. They could see that we were cold on the deck, and one of them lent me a lumber jacket, for which I'm very grateful, and which I sent back to him subsequently, having had it cleaned first, thinking of the possibility of lice eggs remaining in it, you know. Then in London it was good. Our MP was there to welcome us, and Arthur Horner, the Miners' Secretary. And then we were taken for the night somewhere. And I'd heard that it was unfortunate because apparently the Unisable Brass Band had come out to give me a welcome home. But the fact that I stayed in London prevented this happening.
Did you suffer any discrimination for having been in the International Brigade?
No. Not for having been there, but for my political views. That in almost every school I've been in so far, when they hear what my political views are, extreme left, they always try to say, finally, she's got rid of me. In my first job in Pontypridd, they got up a petition. But there's nothing they could do about it, because in my job, I'm absolutely non-political. What else can you be when you're teaching a language? And then when I was up in Burnley, there I also taught not only French language and lit, but also social affairs, social studies. Now, Elaine and I will lecture on social studies, international affairs, and we always pride ourselves on presenting a very objective viewpoint of things. And one day, I was called in the headmaster's room, and I think I made a study up there on vital statistics of the effect of pollution upon vital statistics. I had Mexico, for example, going down in a ring, and the highest death rates, the highest disease rates, were all found in the centre of Manchester. And as you went outwards in rings, all diseases declined, death rates declined, and people lived longer. Now, Burnley was the fourth dirtiest town in Lancashire. I discovered all the doctors there specialised in chest diseases. And my eldest child, before year three, he was suffering from asthma. When the second child was born, 3 years later, he had a hacking cough. So I'd done an awful lot of work on these studies. They were absolutely non-political, quite objective things, mathematical things. And I was attending a meeting in 1945, I think it was, and I created an uproar in the meeting. I simply quoted a statement made by Winston Churchill when he was a liberal, giving his view of the Tory party. I think it's something about patriotism by the imperial pint or something like that. The man said, well, he couldn't answer it, but he'd answer the thing in the next meeting. So I went along to the next meeting. They asked some questions. I said, can I have the answer to the one I asked the previous meeting? So he mumbled something. Any questions? So I stood up again. Went to ask a question. He said, now sit down. They said, sit down. You've asked a question. I said, no, I asked that last week. I've got another one this week. And then they told the usher to throw me out. I said, if you dare do this, I'll sue you under the Representation of the People's Act. They stopped then, let me be asked a question. Then at the end of the meeting, one chap came up to me and said, if I wanted to keep my job in the grammar school, I'd better get out of politics. That was the Councillor Brooks, a rank Tory. Well, other people heard this, and when I got outside the building, there was a huge meeting there. All the Labour councillors were there. They wouldn't fight this, you see. So nothing happened. But then they charged me with propaganda in school with social studies. So I said to the headmaster, one moment, and I went to my locker, got my notes for the whole year. I said, look, I want you to date these and put them in your safe. And the allegation was that I'd been selling tickets to the United in Devon meeting and also taught socialism in school. Well, then I went on to see the director. And I went in, a man called Howarth. And he turned this light right onto my face, you know. Now, I'm hopeless if I'm facing light. I can't see anything. So I just turned the light onto his face. See? I said, I come to question you, not you me. I said, what is this allegation I teach politics in school? That he told me the three boys that brought the allegation, I discovered they were all members of the Young Tories. I went to see the chairman of the governors. He said, a very serious matter. I said, right, fine. I said, I'm countercharging. I'm charging these kids, three kids, with slanders and libels, which could jeopardize my whole career and would be harmful to my material prospects. This is sort of legal jargon you find in the law books, something like that. And when they could see I was serious, they then came and begged me now not to proceed any further, because these kids have their whole careers to think of. Who should I be to spoil them, you see? I said, you don't care about spoiling my career and my whole family because of political spite. Because I said, it's quite untrue, and they know it's untrue. because they made the same allegation against another master there, that he hadn't sold the tickets either. And why sell tickets when the meetings were free anyway? And then I had another job, come back down, and within, after confirmation of the job, the new headmaster tried to rescind the appointment. I was too left wing. Because I'm very well known, whatever. I was up in Lancashire then. This was a job down in Gwent. But they'd heard of me. They wanted to cancel the job. But they never fought me on my results, you see. I don't talk politics. I'm a good teacher and I get very good results. And I do things like camera club, for example, or debating society, or a chess club, produce a play, a thing like that. All non-political. I've always been aware of this. People are more afraid with ideas than anything.
When you were a prisoner in Spain, did you have any cravings of any kind?
Yes. I had a craving for two kinds of food. Those which I often ate and those which I didn't. I had a craving for lettuce, tomatoes and vinegar. Whether those were connected with the scurvy, or if we did have scurvy, I don't know. And then I had a craving for things like eggs, milk, butter, and also a cake known in Welsh as Tishan Lap, which is made of flour, milk, butter, eggs and cheese. However, there was no sexual craving whatsoever there. And although I'd read a good many books about unnatural sexual cravings in prison, as evidence in William McCarthy's book, called, I think, Walls of Ears or Walls of Mouths, where you normally have a degree of homosexuality, there was none apparent in Spain in this concentration camp. And in point of fact, from what I could gather from other people, there were no erotic desires whatsoever. And even once in the summertime when people could see half a dozen girls a few dozen yards away, while there were plenty of cheers and catcalls, there was no real sexual desire whatsoever, due, I think, to the bad feeling. Although when I say bad feeling, I've got to be honest and say that the ordinary prison guards had only slightly better food than us. And the Portuguese prisoners in our camp had said they'd never been so well fed in all their lives as the food they had in this camp.